16.
Take number 16.
July 19th, 2000. Okay. You got the
Fuller's Earth treatment.
Then you went back and.
Back to Manhattan.
You went to town.
Yeah, and met up with Scotty. When seamen come in on the ship, they go to the seamen's home.
Okay, that's where you met up with him, seamen's
home. Yeah, okay. Or in that vicinity. Yeah. You go there no matter what ship you come in on because of mail that arrives at the seamen's home.
Okay.
You know, mail that comes in from all over the world for the sailors. And
so that's how you ran into him. Well, that helps to kind of tighten that up, you know, that part of it. Now, from reading what Nina had, is it Nina or Nina?
Nina.
Nina had typed out that you had.
Okay,
Kim. Okay, thank you. That you had talked to your brother at some point about your stepmother. I don't know whether this is important in the story or. I mean, that's the way I remember this. Some kind of interaction about, well, what happened to her? Was she still alive? So on. Maybe I've got it confused. Maybe you're talking about somebody else. If you don't remember this, then let's forget it. Because
what I do remember is I didn't like my stepmother. And being the baby of the family, I put up with the brunt, you see. And Jewish stepmothers, who are really survivalists in all of these situations,
favored her own children.
She favored her own children. And what's more, a Jewish stepmother, I'm reminded of them by... looking at a nest and where the little ducklings, those who are weak, are pecked to death by the mother.
Okay.
You see, and that's how it is. And that's all I want to say about my stepmother.
Were any of your full sisters and brothers in the home with you at the time that you were with your stepmother? Or were they all gone? Had they all...
They're all gone. They're all gone. I think I was left there with a stepsister, and then my own sister, married.
Okay, so you had a stepsister, and that was it?
Yeah.
One stepsister?
Yeah, one stepsister. I had three brothers, I had three stepbrothers, two daughters, step, and... So 8, 9, 10 people would sit down to dinner.
But you said everybody was gone.
In the old days. I remember the old days when the family was young, you know. But 10 or 12 people would sit down to eat from a huge pot of Russian soup, borscht, or what have you. But with the war, the family was... kind of broken up by the war, you know.
And then your mother died at some point.
My stepmother?
No, your natural mother.
My natural mother died when I was 7.
Okay, so that was before the war, then.
Yeah, before the war.
Okay. And then your father remarried not long after that?
A year later he remarried. Yeah.
And there were still kids at home at that point.
Yes, there were lots of kids at home at that point. And we all kind of got along, you know. But there's a balance of boys and girls, your own and the others, and you could shelter from the storm. But then the war broke that up.
And then you got moved to the country, Danbury.
Yeah.
Okay. Texas, coming up to Alaska. Maybe we've got the bulk of it, I mean, that needs to be put together in some kind of chronological order, and then so that you can then fill in.
Did I ever talk about environments of painters?
I don't know. Say some more.
I vowed, Don Thomas, that I'd visit his grave and I'd piss on it. And the first time I got out of the United States, I'd been firefighting in Alaska, but now I could come and go. I got my green card.
So he was not buried in the U.S.?
No. He was born in Swansea, and he adopted the village of Larn as his home, and he worked there. And
that
Laughran, pronounced Larn.
Mm-hmm.
Did I say E on the end? Yeah,
no.
There's an E on the end.
Okay.
And so I went there with a fellow firefighter, Pierre Benrup, who had relatives in Denmark and in Paris, France. And anyway, I said, we've got to go to this village, you know, I've got to go to this guy's grave, you know. And the village of Larn is not like any other village, and I don't know why it is what it is, because the people who live there are simple folk, all right. And you know, there's no gentrification or middle class people. They're simple folk, but the cottages are painted in pastel colors. It's like looking at an Italian, you know, village. Or a coastal village, you see. So it was unusual in that respect. And because I wanted to go to the grave and do what I promised I would do, but we didn't do that immediately. Pierre was kind of fascinated by this little village, and we asked, where did he work? And they pointed to a place on the cliff, and there was a road that went up the cliff, like a little ridge, but it was really in a bower of leaves and branches. But when you walked up this road, this ridge, it was like no other ridge in the world. You were surrounded by flowers and this bush, you see. And we went to his little house, and it was cantilevered out of the cliff. And a little house it was. It was something you can drag into this house, and it will fit between this refrigerator and this cupboard here. That was the length of it. He would write there, and he would sleep there. It was a little bed. And I looked out to sea. Both of us looked out to sea from this position, because when we went out on this cantilevered thing, we were free of this bower, not... It was just a lovely thing to walk up. But we wanted to see the ocean, and a bird plunged into the ocean. And Pierre said, what the hell was that? And I said, that's the heron diving, which I really didn't know, but it was quite so. It was a line in one of his poems, you see. So anyway, he said, how did you know that? And I said, man, in England, it's an island, so we know all the... you know, the sea birds and all that Tommy Ron. He said, yeah, that's a heron, okay. So we come walking down the bower on the cliff, and there was a kind of a rent in the foliage, and there was a fellow in a farmer's smock with this old hat on his head, and believe it or not, a scythe like Father Time. And he leans through the hedge, and he said, Furbacule, I'm in Under Milkwood, you see. And he was a character in that poem. And we said, of course, we know you are the spitting image of the fellow. We read all about you. It's good to meet you, you see. And he couldn't shake hands because it meant this, what did I call it, the side. Yeah, so we just jostled the leaves and thanked him and moved on. And we went on to the little post office, and sure enough, the lady there was very proud of the fact that she was mentioned in Under Milkwood. And we looked out to sea from the village proper now, and we saw a horrible sight. We looked down at the beach below the cliff, and there was this spanking new aluminum Airstream type mobile home. And I said to the postmistress, I said, in God's name, I thought some Yanks must have pulled this Tommy Rock, because they were buying property all over the place. And she said, no, that's the widow of Dylan Thomas, and that's where she likes to live, in this god-awful trailer. I don't know how she got it down there. They must have lowered it down there. And I had no desire to meet her. I was hovering around the hospital, St. Vincent's, and she turned up and at one point climbed out on the fire escape and wanted to die and stuff like that, you know.
Was that when he was in the hospital? Is that what you were
saying? Yeah.
That was in New York?
In New York, yeah.
Okay. So she came to New York or was living there with him when he died?
She came to New York.
He died within a few days of his collapse, didn't he?
Grateful for the heron diving. I remember saying that to Pierre. I've always sought out the places where artists live. It's really, I think that has turned me on more than being told I have talent or what have you. That experience. I remember.
Hey, what mean the ambience? Or what?
All right. What
turned you on?
I was in Paris, and I thought this is an opportunity to go to Fountains of Roses, Fontenelle aux Roses, which is the hometown of Bernard, and. I learned that you can get the train and go right there and get out of the station. And I thought, wow, this is for me. And I've always admired the work of Bernard. You always run into young painters who say, well, I've got talent. I have more talent than Bernard. Then they discover that they don't have more talent than Bernard. You see, but I've always never felt that way. I've always learned something. Anyway, I arrived in Fontenelle aux Roses, and it was raining like hell. And all the colors were kind of a brown umber, a green, and the gray sky and rain. And when you get out of the railroad station, the town appears to be on a hill. And I wandered all over this side of the hill. And the thing that was so confusing is that there was a feeling of deja vu, a feeling that I'd been there before, and that surely I'll find the studio. I went into the little place and ordered a sandwich and spoke to the proprietor, and I said, the Maison, the Maître Pierre Bonnard, and the people would talk very effusively and say, à gauche, à droite, and something. And I find myself wandering around. I even ran into the postman with his bicycle, and I said, I'm looking for the atelier of Pierre Bonnard. And once again, he was very effusive and made a speech, and how wonderful, you know, on a day like this, there are people who come, blah, blah, blah. And I still couldn't find the place. And now I'm on the other side of the hill, and I'm soaked to the skin in the rain. And I heard some sounds in a building, a modern building there they were building. And I went in there, and I said, I saw a sign that said the bus to Paris, you see, and the number of the bus was to the arrondissement in which I lived. I thought, wow, what luck, I won't have to walk over the hill and get on the train. It seemed that I'd spent all day, and then I said to these workmen, how often does the bus come? And a fellow up his watch and said, there'll be one here in 3 minutes. I thought, yeah, that's bloody likely. So I thought, in 3 minutes, I better get over to the bus stop. Well, I remember looking at the times, you know, of the bus arrival and departures on this little enamel plated thing, and I looked up, and the sky had turned green, see. And I looked around, and I thought, oh my God, I don't feel good. Man, I'm dizzy. I caught something like pneumonia, you know. And I looked at the houses, and the water was sparkling, you see. I mean, in reds and golds and greens and blues. And there were little ornaments, you know, in the rain, there were these concrete ornaments on the lawn, you know, these things, toadstools and fairies and things like that. And these were all a glimmer with color. And I thought, Jesus, what's going on here? And I'm holding onto the lamppost. And I remember opening the garden gate and looking at the mortar between the bricks. And because of this phenomena of green skies, and the people greet this by putting pieces of mirrors and things that reflect the light in the mortar. So this is only, his neighbors told him how to go about this, you see. So, and how well he used that. You see this mosaic, you know, that flows through his work. And anyway, the bus came in 3 minutes, you see. And I climbed aboard and went back to Paris. And I remember the bus conductor knew that I was so fascinated by this. And he said, it's the reservoir out of town that gives them this green color or something like that. I mean, here is this environment, you see, and the people in all walks of life have done this thing, and what else can you do but do it and then move, you know, this is the baseline of other things that you do. He had, the contract that he had was one that was very common in France, but I don't know whether it still exists. Namely that an art gallery will go to an art school and look at the graduates and decide who should join their gallery. And they sign on for the rest of their lives. Now some will be successful and some will not be successful. In the same gallery as Bonnard was Pierre Talcot and Soulages, and these were substantive artists, but they never had the fame of Bonnard, you see. Bonnard learnt that Ruault, who was a member of the same gallery, had moved into a villa in southern France, and he went to the dealer and says, why don't I have a villa like Ruault, you know, with the, what am I, chopped liver? You know, you're selling my things for thousands. I can't keep up with it. So they promised him a villa in southern France. Ruault had a limousine and a chauffeur, and the gallery said, "We'll when we come to that, we'll think about that for you, Bernard. We'll get you a car, at least, and someone to drive it." And one day, Ruault got up, decided all his drawings were worthless. And neighbors complained that smoke coming from his incinerator over a period of days. His dealer discovered that he'd burnt the most of his drawings. We're talking about a loss of, you know, something in the magnitude of $25 million. And the gallery hauled him into court. And they said that the artist has a right to destroy his work. You cannot interfere with that. So they dismissed the case. But thereafter, he had to number every work, and there was a database for everything he did. And thereafter, a representative of the gallery lived with him, who was ostensibly the chauffeur to his limousine, to keep an eye on him. Meanwhile, Bernard goes into action. He drives around this area. He never did the inspired works in southern France as he did in Fontenay or Rose. And he went into a provincial museum, and in the place of honor was one of his paintings. And he looked at it, and he sent his chauffeur out to the car and said, "Bring me my paint box. I have to fix something here." So he painted on the painting. And this time the museum took him into court. And they said a painter can only enhance a painting. He has a right to enhance a painting. If he thinks there's something wrong with it, what are you complaining about? So they dismissed the charge. So these two people, you know, in a different ambiance, and they are not doing what they did so devotedly with such inspiration, but they were pissing around doing these goddamn things.
This reminds me of you saying that in New York, the museums didn't want the painters coming in.
No.
I mean, I suppose they could see their own work and get upset and decide they're going to change it. I mean, when it isn't theirs anymore, really, but I imagine that could happen, right? They could be angry and decide it's awful and want to destroy it. Is that possible?
The painters don't really like museums. Those who are...
So it's other reasons, it's not that.
Yeah, and frequently a living artist will go into a museum, be drunk and raise hell, you see, and get into a brawl with a curator. Painters are not welcome, particularly when... painting was done, in a genteel bohemian poverty caused by money flowing to the French and the British and the Germans. I think I went into this, you know. It was a very frustrating life for painters, and these museums which were championing these foreign schools, you know, making them an official school in the United States. I remember picketing the Metropolitan Museum, because they refused to show our work, you see. And we won, you know. I'm reminded that at the turn of the century, a little boy named Tommy Murphy, he was a newspaper boy in McDougal Street, and he had a paper route. He was 12, and he would deliver the New York Times, and he had a client who lived in the attic of this building. His name was Albert Pinkham Ryder. But on this occasion, there was a headline. It was that Pinkham Ryder, his work has been acquired by the Metropolitan Museum of Art, turn of the century. Very rare thing. So the newspaper boy, Tommy Murphy, actually delivered the paper to Albert. He ran up the staircase, which he'd never done before. He just threw the paper in there. And Albert opened the door, you know, wondering what the day will wrought. And little Tommy said, "Gee, Albert, I didn't know you were an artist." You see, and that was reverberated down the decades. Tommy Murphy saying, "I didn't know you were an artist, Albert." And he would deliver. But I mean, that was a very rare thing, that a living artist was, but of course living artists in France, including Picasso, were included in all these ensembles, you know. Mm-hmm. They had no problem whatsoever. Possibly they thought, well, the guy lives in France, is going to come over here and raise hell or piss in the fireplace, which is what Jackson Pollock did to Mr. Guggenheim's place. Fireplace. The environment, Tommy Murphy, I think he became a police commissioner in New York and was very kind to artists, incidentally. In France, I used to, the rival, I don't know whether I went into this before, the coffee shops and Giacometti, I did. Okay. His wife and the car that left. Did I?
The car that left.
Yeah. I went in there and I...
You went to the stable.
Yeah. And I...
this woman got up.
Yeah. Yeah. We had that, yeah. And this was his wife.
Yes, right.
And she was returning to the chateau. Oh, okay.
Right.
The home of Renoir in France. Did I go into that?
That?
I thought, well, the reason I... Because I'm an artist, I appreciate how what they picked up from you know, their environment, you see, and how familiar we are with these places, you know, as far apart as Alon in Wales, Sumer of Renoir, Cagnes-sur-Mer, and yet they're able to distill some essence of these places. And we, Patty and me on our honeymoon visited the home of Renoir. And we walked around the place, and Cagnes seemed, it is, there's a colonnade of trees, and plateaus of land and meadows that go right down to the Mediterranean, which is blue and the sky is blue. And somehow I thought, God, I see nudes in this colonnade of trees. I said, no, it can't be. Then I tried to think of paintings where you would have had nudes, but I couldn't think of any. Nevertheless, here were these... creatures are running around and then posing when I looked at them. And we found shards of pottery in a shed, and it seems he once did the decorative brushwork on dishes and cups and things like that. But we never took any of that. He just
when
was
you say we, who you mean?
Patty and myself.
That was
uncanny. Yeah. And then I thought, God, what on earth is going on here? Because, and then we visited the house, and then we were by this, what I call a colonnade of trees. And I said, you know, I keep seeing nudes. And she said, I do too, you see. So I thought it's time to leave, you know, this magic place. And as we passed the house, this grizzled hand placed this breadboard in the sun to dry.
Out of a window or what?
Yeah, out of a basement window. And in a panic.
Okay, say it again.
I looked at Patty. She looked at me. We looked at this breadboard that had came out of the basement kitchen.
Of Renoir's
home. Mm-hmm. And we put it in the car and drove out of there like bank robbers.
Was Renoir still living at the time?
No, he'd long since dead. We drove in, the car was Avis, an Avis rental car, and we were to return the car to Cannes. This journey began in Paris, and the car was to be returned to Cannes, and then we were to get the bus up the coast to Valries. Okay, so we had seven suitcases of things, you know, which was a real drag, and believe it or not, after all the panic and speeding away from Renoir's home, so the police and the Air Force were smashes into a molecule, we finally got everything aboard a bus, or it was to be delivered, or some damn thing. I remember once we lost a suitcase in Paris, and we were so happy that we were actually annoyed when they called up to say, we have your suitcase, and we were, oh no. And, but anyway, we got back to Valerie's and unloaded all of our stuff, and we couldn't find the breadboard. And I said, my God, where's the breadboard? You know, I mean, every mile on the road, we thought we had Renoir's breadboard, you see. And you know, let's drive carefully and stuff like that so the police don't pick us up and spot the breadboard. So we thought, what the hell do we do? I said, well, let's forget about it. I mean, what can we do? But we forgot it at Avis in Cannes. So incredibly, Patty called them up, and she said, this is a risky undertaking. She said, we left our breadboard in the car. Do you have it? And there was a gaggle of laughter, a guy saying, ah, la fool American, crazy Americans. And they said, the man said, the block of wood, madame? The block of wood. And she said, yeah, we call this a breadboard in America. He said, yes, we have the block of wood. As a, you know, we're real stupid people. And, you know, he said, we threw it in the garbage, but we'll get it out, and you come and pick it up. So that was the most brilliant theft of anything we ever conducted in our lives, and we bundled it. But we went back to Avis, and they had the block of wood, you know. And I spoke about Picasso going there.